This is VOA News. We are remote. I'm Marissa Melton. More than 1,000 people have been arrested in Russia after protesting the prison sentence handed down to opposition politician Alexei Navalny. Navalny was sentenced Tuesday to 2 years and 8 months in a penal colony for violating parole while undergoing treatment for poisoning in Germany. His lawyer says he will appeal the sentence. U.S. Secretary of State Tony Blinken called on the Russian government to immediately and unconditionally release Navalny. Britain, Germany, France, and others issued similar statements. Monitoring group OVD Info reported the number of protesters arrested. Navalny's team later posted a message to social media thanking supporters and urging them to go home. The message laid the blame for Navalny's sentence squarely on Russian President Vladimir Putin. The message read, quote, "Putin failed to kill Alexei Navalny and therefore decided to put him in jail for 2 years and 8 months. We will never tolerate a government that kills opponents and imprisons innocent people." The court found Navalny violated his parole from a 2014 suspended sentence by failing to notify prison authorities of his whereabouts when he was evacuated to Berlin for treatment following a near-fatal poisoning attack. "What more could I have done?" Navalny asked the court. "I was in a coma." International media investigations suggest that Navalny is correct to blame Russian security services as the source of the attack. They're believed to have laced his underwear with a military-grade nerve agent, Novichok, while he was traveling in Siberia last August. Russian authorities denied this. The opposition politician has long argued his 2014 conviction for embezzlement was politically motivated in order to disqualify him for running from office under current Russian law. From Washington, you're listening to VOA News. UN Special Rapporteur on Myanmar, Tom Andrews, said Tuesday the military takeover in that country is unacceptable and requires a strong and unequivocal international response. Andrews told VOA that the takeover is, quote, "an assault on an entire people." He called it outrageous and said the international community should respond directly, forcefully, and responsibly. Myanmar's military seized power on Monday, declaring a year-long state of emergency and detaining de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi and President Win Myint, among others. The power grab took place following days of tension between the military and the ruling National League for Democracy, or NLD, which won the November elections. The military has refused to accept the results, alleging massive election fraud. Andrews called the takeover the theft of a democracy. House Democratic impeachment managers and lawyers for former U.S. President Donald Trump on Tuesday laid out their arguments in separate briefs ahead of the former president's Senate trial next week on charges of inciting a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol building on January 6th. The House Democratic prosecutors charged that Trump endangered the lives of practically all members of Congress and jeopardized the democratic process when he urged a mob of supporters who had massed near the Capitol building to try and prevent the certification of Democrat Joe Biden's election victory over Trump. Trump's defense lawyers reject the charges and contend that the impeachment trial is unconstitutional. They say there's no precedent for trying a president after he has left office. They also say the former president stands by his claim that the election results were suspect, and they say his statements about the election were protected under the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. The filings foreshadow the legal arguments both sides will present as the Senate meets next Tuesday to start deliberating whether to convict the 74-year-old former president and perhaps bar him from returning to office. The trial is expected to last about a week. The United States said Tuesday it was too early to accept an Iranian proposal for the EU to help revive a nuclear deal, reiterating calls on Tehran to come into full compliance with the 2015 pact aimed at keeping Iran from developing nuclear weapons. President Joe Biden's administration will be consulting with allies, consulting with partners, consulting with Congress before we're reaching the point before we're going to engage directly with Iranians and be willing to entertain any sort of proposal. Those were the words of State Department spokesman Ned Price talking to reporters today. Via remote, I'm Marissa Melton. From Washington, you're listening to VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February the 3rd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Former South African President Jacob Zuma will not cooperate with a corruption commission.
There is a feeling of anticipation. What happens now? Will he be charged with contempt? Will the courts step in and do their job, or will he get away with it as he has done on many, many occasions?
South Africa sees two breaks in coronavirus fight. There are mixed reactions from Africa to President Joe Biden's pro-choice stance. Hundreds of Zimbabweans are homeless after their properties flooded. And a new biography about Guinea-Bissau independence hero Amical Cabral.
He was the founder of PAIGC, who fought for the independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. But they have also a lot of influence on the independence of Angola.
And Cameroon is seeing resurgence of leprosy 20 years after its eradication. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. There are calls for former South African President Jacob Zuma to be suspended from the ruling African National Congress. This after Mr. Zuma this week announced that he will not cooperate with the Zondo Commission, which has been looking into corruption allegations against him. Mr. Zuma was summoned to appear before the commission from February 18 to the 19th. However, in a statement this week, Mr. Zuma said he would not cooperate with the commission. He accused the commission of persecuting him in a way similar to the apartheid regime. Zuma also accused the Constitutional Court of political bias. The leader of the Eastern Cape Province ANC was quoted in the Mail and Guardian newspaper as calling for disciplinary action against Mr. Zuma, including suspension for refusing to appear before the commission. Shanila Mohammed is executive director of Amnesty International, South Africa.
So the reaction from South Africa has been quite mixed. I mean, Jacob Zuma has a large support base. You see that coming out every time Zuma makes a statement or appears in front of any court or public or doesn't appear. But on the other side, there's also a lot of anger. People are actually quite shocked, to be honest, that Zuma would do this and that he would go against the highest court in the land. And now I think there is a feeling of anticipation. What happens now? Will he be charged with contempt? Will the court step in and do their job, or will he get away with it as he has done on many, many occasions?
He says that the commission is politically biased and that he's being persecuted in a manner, according to him, reminiscent of the apartheid era. Is there any evidence to what he's saying?
There's no evidence at all to support what he's saying, James. And I think the fact that he is actually using a comparison of the apartheid system with the Zondo Commission is actually appalling. We all know what apartheid was. We all know what it did. The Zondo Commission is nothing. I mean, to compare it to apartheid is really unforgivable.
You mentioned the allegations against Raymond Zondo. Mr. Zuma also seemed to be very personal about the Chief Justice.
Yes, he is. And in his statement, he basically accuses the Chief Justice of being part of this whole conspiracy. And, you know, the ironic thing is if you read his statement, he contradicts himself continuously. So on the one hand, you know, he talks about the fact that the Chief Justice at some point had told him that he was going to appoint Judge Desai and then appointed Raymond Zondo, and he sees that as a conspiracy. He also talks about the fact that the way in which the courts have treated him is all part of the conspiracy that he's trying to. And I think that that is one of the reasons why he does not want to appear before the Zondo Commission, because the evidence that is available there will totally pull the carpet out from under his legs. And, you know, he knows he has no leg to stand on.
You know, Shanila, you alluded to this earlier in the interview. What do you think are the implications, say, come February 8th or so, and Mr. Zuma makes good on his threat not to appear before the commission? What are the implications?
Well, the implications is that he will be cited for contempt of court. It carries a prison sentence if he's found guilty, which, you know, if he does not appear, he will be. And, you know, the thing is that, Zuma If you look at the wordings of his statement, you know, he's trying to speak in the same tone that Mandela did at the Rivonia trial, where Mandela talked about sacrifice to his country and that he was willing, you know, if necessary, to die for his country and willing to go for jail. And if you look at the wordings, I think that that's a similar thing that Jacob Zuma is trying to do, where he's talking about, you know, he is willing to go to jail, you know, for the sake of the country, for the sake of justice, you know, etc. So he's positioning himself very much as a victim at the hands of an apartheid-like system. And the aim of this is really to get the sympathy from his masses, the masses that are supporting him. Now, Zuma, you know, undeniably has a large number of people, especially in KwaZulu-Natal, who support him. And, you know, that whole statement that was released yesterday was talking to his supporters. It was really about, you know, look at me, I'm being victimized once again. I am a leader. I have done nothing wrong. And, you know, the whole system has been set up to target me.
Shanela, thank you so much. It's so nice to talk with you. Thank you very much.
No worry, James. Give me a shout anytime.
Shanela Mohammed is Executive Director of Amnesty International South Africa. She was speaking with us from Johannesburg. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa delivered a rare shot of good news to people in Africa's coronavirus hotspot. The president said South Africa's second wave appears to be abating and that the government will soon launch a vaccination campaign for health workers. VOA's Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
For nearly a year, President Cyril Ramaphosa has been the bearer of grim news of deaths, of rising caseloads and burdened hospitals, of lockdowns and restrictions, and of endless reminders like a chiding father urging, wear your mask, wash your hands. South Africa is the continent's viral hotspot, with 1.4 million confirmed cases since the virus arrived in March. The nation experienced the start of a second wave of the virus, featuring a new variant that is significantly more contagious in late December. But this week, a stab of hope. On Monday, the president and top ministers stood on the sodden airport tarmac in Johannesburg to greet the arrival of 1 million vaccine doses. They will, in the next 2 weeks, make their way into the arms of frontline healthcare workers. After that, Ramaphosa said, the country will vaccinate 40 million people, about 67% of the population, by year's end. He emphasized that no one will be required to take the vaccine. He spoke live on national TV late Monday.
Fellow South Africans, the first set of good news is the arrival of the vaccine today. The second is that we have recorded our lowest daily increase in infections since the beginning of December of last year. In fact, the average rate of new infections has been steadily coming down over the last 3 weeks, indicating that we have now passed the peak of the second wave.
South Africa will now become the fifth African nation to roll out mass vaccinations, after Morocco, Egypt, the Seychelles, and Guinea. Ramaphosa also announced that in his role as chairman of the African Union, he had worked to secure 1 billion vaccines for the African continent. Ramaphosa is the only African leader in the G20 and has publicly exhorted wealthy nations to share the vaccines equitably.
We have to date secured 1 billion vaccines for the entire continent. 700 million of these will come through the global COVAX facility, and 300 million have been facilitated by the African Vaccine Acquisition Task Team. We will be getting other vaccines that will be donated by various private sector companies to add to the vaccines that our continent needs.
Ramaphosa also announced that his government would ease current restrictions, including loosening the overnight curfew and allowing the resumption of alcohol sales. But he warned, that doesn't mean South Africa should breathe a sigh of relief yet.
Let us remember that despite the clear progress we have made, the number of new cases is still high, and there is an ever-present danger of a resurgence. It is therefore necessary to maintain the country on coronavirus alert level 3, indicating the continued high risk of transmission.
And he said, even as millions of South Africans receive the vaccination, it remains mandatory for everyone to wear a mask in public. He also reminded his people, keep your distance and wash your hands. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
There have been mixed reactions from African organizations to U.S. President Joe Biden's decision to end a policy barring U.S. aid to organizations that inform women about abortion. Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town.
The World Health Organization says most African countries have signed the 2003 Maputo Protocol, which regards abortion as a human right in certain circumstances, such as when a woman's life is at risk or in the case of sexual assault. The countries that still forbid abortion include Mauritius, Madagascar, Senegal, Gabon, Guinea-Bissau, and Congo. Under former President Donald Trump, the U.S. barred aid to organizations that give information about abortions or perform them, which often cut funding for birth control, maternal health, and other women's health needs. Biden's new order allows funds to go to those organizations, although U.S. funds cannot pay for abortions. One group working to put a stop to abortion is Doctors for Life. Chairperson Dr. Albu van Eerden says they have about 1,600 members globally. He says Biden's move is a blow to their cause.
Well, obviously we are very, very disappointed about it. We've learned that from the Nazis. The moment you say under certain circumstances you can take the life of a human being, then you're on the wrong track. And by this time, if you look at embryological textbooks and the Carnegie stages of fetal development, which is really the gold standard, they all maintain the conviction that life starts at fertilization.
Pro-choice consultant and the departing director of the Sexual and Reproductive Justice Coalition, Marion Stevens, has welcomed Biden's move.
Of course it makes a difference, but we expected no less.
Stevens has called for steps to be taken to make big private foundations that have anti-abortion funding policies in place more accountable.
So you have a private foundation who can say, we'll fund your program on sexual and reproductive health, but we'll only fund this part and not that part. So we'll only fund long-acting contraceptives. We won't fund an approach that enables women to determine their own options and choices.
The World Health Organization's Dr. Haifa Elliman in Zimbabwe says Biden's decision has wide impact.
It affects all the NGOs and programs that are working in the Afro region in sexual reproductive health to be more effective, and we'll have more funding. Furthermore, it will ensure us to be able to reach the most vulnerable women, adolescents, women living in poverty.
Medical experts say firm numbers regarding abortion are hard to come by. The World Health Organization's website says in developing countries, around 7 million women are admitted to hospitals every year as a result of unsafe abortions. It also says the risk of dying from unsafe abortions is highest in Africa. This is Vicky Stark for Voice of America News in Cape Town.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, February the 3rd. Heavy rains have left hundreds of Zimbabweans homeless after their properties built on wetlands flooded. Authorities are blaming land barons for selling the plots to unsuspecting citizens and are refusing to help the homeless who illegally built on the wetlands. Columbus Mavunga reports from Chitungwiza, Zimbabwe.
62-year-old Adeline Gweshe scoops water into a bucket and pours it outside her home. Most of her goods are now on top of bricks in her house since water is seeping in and is now above her toes.
I'm not even happy staying in this place from the first, but I don't have money to go anywhere. So I told them that I don't want this place, and they said this is the only place left. So no option, I just took it.
Gweshe says 10 years ago, she bought this piece of land on which to build her home from a person people here call a land baron. That is the term for criminals who hoodwink desperate home seekers, falsely claiming they own a piece of land and selling it to the unsuspecting. The land Gweshe purchased is wetland that often becomes flooded. Now she's one of hundreds of people in Chitungwiza, 40 kilometers southeast of Harare, whose homes are underwater. The floods prompted United Nations aid agencies to move in to avert a possible outbreak of waterborne diseases. The usual water sources, open wells, are flooded and likely contaminated. Christopher Ngwerume is an emergency specialist from UNICEF Zimbabwe.
The government will be looking more into the medium to long-term solution for these affected populations. But from our side as the humanitarian actors, we are more concerned about identification of potential evacuation centers and ensuring that those evacuation centers have got adequate materials and supplies to be able to support them during the time of evacuation.
After images of flooding houses in Chitungwiza filled social media, officials from President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government visited the area. Among them was July Moyo, the Minister of Local Government. He blamed the affected homeowners for illegally building on wetlands and not following the law.
If it appears that it's a wetland, we have to get clearance from EMA, from the Minister of Environment, to make sure that we are not building in wetlands. So this is totally unusual. It's not our planning model, and that's why we know that there is corrective measures that have to be taken.
Destroying illegal structures may be among them, the government minister said. For Adeline Gweshe and others left with uninhabitable homes, it's still not clear where they will go. Columbus Mafunga for VOA News, Chitungwiza, Zimbabwe.
Angolan author Antonio Thomas has written a new biography about independence hero Amilcar Cabral that explores Cabral's life in a way he hopes will critically reflect existing ways of thinking and writing about the independence of Lusophone Africa. Thomas spoke to Ricky Stryak about the new book and why looking at Cabral in a new light can improve how others analyze events in Lusophone Africa.
A great part of people have written on Cabral are from this generation. I'm one of the few that has written on Cabral who was born after the killing of Cabral in 73. So this is one aspect. You know, I haven't met Cabral, so I don't write from a personal point of view. So, and I think another aspect of this is that I'm also one of the few people writing on Cabral who are from the countries whose independence Cabral fought for, right? He was the founder of PAIGC, who fought for independence of Guinea and Cape Verde. But they have also a lot of influence on independence of Angola, you know. He worked in Angola. He went to school with Agostinho Neto and other Angolan nationalists and so on. And Cabral's ideas were applied for Angolan independence.
Why personally were you drawn to writing a book about Cabral?
Yeah, thank you. This is a very interesting question, because before going to the US for my PhD and before coming to South Africa, where I work and live now, I lived in Portugal for 9 years. I went to Portugal for college, and I was in late 90s. And now in Portugal, you know, people start to talk about racism, and people start to talk about the consequences of racism, particularly the relationship between racism and colonialism. But back in the 90s, nobody was talking about that. You know, people were talking about Lusophonia, and people were talking about this very colonial idea that the Portuguese were very kind of special colonizers, that they had a very particular relationship with the people they colonized and so on. You know, that was like the propaganda that were used during Salazar in the 60s. So I really think that there was something that was missing in this discussion, in this post-colonial discussion. But the part that was missing was what was there about colonialism that pushed these young men to leave everything they had, family, life, to fight against colonialism.
What are the challenges or pitfalls of writing a book about someone like Cabral, who died so young, unfortunately, that he's quite revered.
It's not an easy book to write about, you know, because we need these figures and we need heroes and so on. We should engage with these figures in a different way, because it's been almost 50 years since the death of Cabral, you know, and now 50 years later, we are now at the other end of history, you know, at facing the consequences that that the whole process of independence brought us.
That was Antonio Thomas, author of a new biography about Amical Cabral, entitled Amical Cabral, The Life of a Reluctant Nationalist. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Johannesburg. Cameroon is seeing a resurgence of leprosy, the bacterial infectious disease that causes severe disfiguring skin sores and nerve damage. Cameroon health authorities on Sunday's World Leprosy Day said infections have jumped about 50% since 2018. As Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, leprosy patients say, just as in ancient times, they are shunned and neglected.
Cameroon, two decades ago, announced that it had eliminated leprosy, but around 200 cases continued to be reported each year. In 2019, cases of the bacterial disease, which damages skin and nerves, increased to 270, and last year jumped to over 300. Ernest Njitaba is permanent secretary of Cameroon's National Committee for Leprosy. He says a number of Cameroon's health districts have been reporting outbreaks of the chronic but curable condition.
About 70 new cases have been reported in the southwest. We have hotspots in regions like the north, the Adamawa, the southwest, the northwest. People think that leprosy is a spell, it is divine punishment, it's caused by witchcraft, it is hereditary, and so on. Leprosy is none of these.
Taba was attending an event organized by the aid group Circle of Friends of Cameroon for Sunday's World Leprosy Day. Aid groups handed out small gifts of food, soup, and toiletries to 30 leprosy patients at the Jamo Hospital in Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. 51-year-old Patrice Esola says they never received such attention as most families abandoned relatives with leprosy.
Étant donné que la lèpre rend quelqu'un diminue.
He says they need more assistance because they have been rendered helpless by leprosy. Esola says communities should stop thinking that leprosy patients are witches and wizards and instead give care, support and comfort the patients need to recover from it. He says they are poor and need help, not the mental torture some families inflict on them. The Cameroon Baptist Convention's Center for Hope helps care for leprosy patients in the northwestern town of Mbingu. Head of the center's leprosy department, Fomban Oliver, says Cameroon was too quick to declare the disease eradicated. Speaking via a messaging application, he says Cameroon shouldn't have closed some treatment centers and stopped education on the disease.
If it is possible for the government to reinstate the treatment centers, that would be wonderful. If we don't do that, something alarming is going to happen. In the field, there are no longer leprosy inspectors or supervisors or those controlling leprosy. Even the new nurses and the new doctors are up now, they know little about leprosy. And if something is not done in the nearest future, an increase, it will be alarming.
The health ministry official in charge of leprosy in Yaoundé, Dian Jok, says they are encouraging all suspected cases to be taken to hospitals. She says the government will never neglect the suffering of leprosy patients.
Notre présence démontre à suffisance.
Njok says patients are treated and given food free of charge in four specialized centers, and that people with the disease can be rushed to any of the 380 district hospitals in Cameroon. She says civilians should stop stigma and social exclusion of leprosy patients. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
And that's it for this Wednesday, February 30 edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Butter in Washington saying have a good day.